Welcome back to Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Ethan Elkind. I'm sitting in for Rose Aguilar. And for those of you just joining us, I want to let you know we are podcasting our show. You can find out more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up next. And if you have a show idea for us, you can always drop us a line. We're on email at yourcall@kalw.org. You can also call us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. And we also want to hear from you for this next segment. We're going to be talking about health insurance policies and autism. So if you know someone with autism who's affected by health insurance policies, or if you have thoughts about what needs to be done to fix the healthcare system for challenges like autism, you can join the conversation by calling us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. So now we're going to discuss a recent expose by ProPublica about how United Healthcare has been trying to limit and has been limiting mental health coverage and treatment for thousands of children with autism in order to cut costs and limit care to patients. Annie Waldman is a reporter at ProPublica covering healthcare, and you can read her piece, United Health is Strategically Limiting Access to Critical Treatment for Kids with Autism, and we have that posted on our website at yourcallradio.org. Well, welcome to the program, Annie, and thank you for this really important article.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Ethan.
So, Annie, the killing of United Healthcare CEO Brian Thompson on December 4th sparked a real debate about how aggressively United Healthcare has been denying claims. And United Health, of course, is America's largest health insurer and its most notorious denier of claims. And you profile in your piece a person, Maynard, who is raising a child, Benji, alone in South Central Louisiana. And you really paint a picture of just how challenging it is for Benji with autism and for Benji's caretaker to care for that condition. Can you just talk about how you came to learn about Benji and his case and what's been happening more broadly with United Healthcare and treatment for autism?
Yeah. So over the last year, my colleagues and I at ProPublica have really started to look at health insurance and mental health care. You know, we at ProPublica have looked at health insurance for many years, but we mostly focus on the medical surgical side of things and not on mental health care or behavioral health care. So this year, we turned our attention to that. And, you know, in hundreds of interviews with providers and patients, one company in particular stood out, and that's United Health Group and its subsidiaries, United Healthcare and Optum, which manages the insurer's mental health benefits. And over the course of our reporting, we obtained leaked documents from inside the company that reveal what is effectively the company's internal playbook for limiting mental health coverage. You know, from those documents, we actually found that the company has what is in effect a secret internal cost-cutting campaign, which is targeting a growing financial burden for the company, which is the treatment of thousands of children with autism around the country. And so when I saw these documents and started to pore over, you know, these internal records, I wanted to understand how is this impacting families on the ground. And so I'm based in New Orleans in Louisiana, and I started kind of reaching out to folks in the advocacy space and, you know, facilities that provide therapy for children with autism. And that's how I connected with one family, that of Sherelle Menard and her son, Benji. Benji is 10 years old. He's severely affected by autism. He's minimally speaking. He's able to just speak a few dozen words, and he often gets frustrated when struggling to communicate. So he has been in this therapy for a number of years that his mother says is one of the only things that has helped him develop critically important skills. But last year, you know, when he was going through some behavioral stuff and his providers wanted to increase the number of hours that he was in therapy, United Healthcare actually denied him the additional hours of therapy that his clinical team said that he needed to thrive. You know, they essentially said that he had been in this therapy for too long, and more progress should have been expected. And that's why they denied him the care that he and his clinical team said he needed. So his family and his clinical team are continuing to fight this denial. They're actually in a couple of days going to an administrative law hearing to try to get the denial overturned. But if it's not overturned, his family is not in a place to be able to afford this therapy out of pocket. And like many families, Sherelle has found something that we've heard from families across the country, which is insurers have assumed a really outsized influence over the medical and mental health needs of families in this country.
Can you talk, Annie, just about what's at stake with this treatment? What is the treatment? How effective is it? Why is it so important?
Yeah, of course. So, you know, the therapy that Sherelle is trying to obtain for her son is called applied behavior analysis. It's just a type of specialized treatment to help children with autism develop skills. That can be communication skills, developmental skills, social or language skills, attention and focus skills. It essentially breaks down the learning process into basic steps using repetition and positive reinforcement to affirm behaviors. This therapy, according to the internal documents, UnitedHealthcare has, you know, 10,000 children within its Medicaid networks, which have autism spectrum disorder. And this has been a growing number in recent years. You know, the number of children diagnosed with autism has been rapidly increasing from one in 150 kids over, you know, two decades ago to one in 36 kids today. Many experts say this is largely due to a greater awareness and improved screening of children, but this has also led to an increased need for services and therapies. And this has put pressure on the company's bottom line, which is why in these documents, we saw that the company has essentially developed these quote unquote market specific action plans to limit access to this care.
And how did you get this document? Describe a bit more about what it says. I mean, you just talked about some of the highlights here, but just what are some of the kind of big highlights that you found from this sort of this playbook from the company?
Yeah. So inside this playbook, you know, we found that the company acknowledges that this therapy, this is what they call it, is the gold standard treatment. Those are the company's words. And they essentially state in these documents that they're aware that there are very long wait lists for this therapy. But even with those long wait lists and the, you know, desire that many families have to put their children in this therapy, the company said that it's actually, quote, aiming to prevent new providers from joining the network and, quote, terminate existing ones using factors such as cost outliers. You know, it's worth noting that if an insurer drops a provider from its network, patients may have to find a new clinician that accepts their insurance, or they could have to pay tens of thousands of dollars a year out of pocket for this therapy. And that can be incredibly difficult for families. You know, the company in these documents calculated that in some states, this reduction that they are making could impact more than two-fifths of the therapy provider groups that are in their network and up to one in five kids in therapy. In addition to removing providers from their networks, the company is also scrutinizing the medical necessity of the therapy for individual patients with what they call rigorous clinical reviews. And those reviews can essentially lead to denials of covered treatment. You know, Optum has also said that it has this approach to authorizing less units than requested, which implies that the company could essentially be approving fewer hours of therapy than requested, which is what we saw in Benji's case.
Well, and of course, denials get a lot of attention and coverage to the extent that people are on this issue. And we're glad that you're covering it for sure. But what about delay? I mean, you talked about just here with this playbook, why is delay so important from a health insurance company's bottom line?
Yeah. So, you know, many Americans experience this. You know, their employer may shift insurance companies from one year to the next, or many people across the country may, you know, switch employers, and therefore they might go with a different insurance company. The other thing is a lot of people may switch to Medicare or Medicaid or back to a private insurance or an insurance that they find on an exchange, a state-run exchange. So, you know, there many insurance companies are aware that people bounce from different insurance companies. And therefore, you know, if you think about healthcare economics, you know, the risk is lower if, you know, one family or one patient stays with an insurance company over the course of their entire life. But in reality, we know that's not the case. And so, you know, many times delaying the delivery of these services, you know, health insurers may not be responsible for actually covering those services when patients finally fight for that access to it.
And Annie, how are these companies able to get away with it? Are there any restrictions on their ability to do this? Just seems like almost a case of fraud that an insurance company is promising to cover someone when they're ill, but then when the illness comes up, if the treatment is too expensive, they're just going to delay and figure out a strategy to deny. How can this be legal or go unregulated?
That's a great question. You know, legislators have been looking at this for a number of years. You know, there are federal protections under the Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act, also known as MAPEA, which passed in 2008. Federal law requires insurance companies to provide the same access to mental and physical health care. So essentially, you know, insurance companies are not allowed to discriminate against the mental or behavioral services. It, you know, if they're providing those physical and medical services, they also have to do the same on the mental and behavioral healthcare side. But, you know, what we have found in practice is that this is not always the case. You know, insurance companies sometimes use limitations on the mental health care side that they're not using on the medical or surgical side, whether they're using more stringent standards to kind of, you know, withhold care, or whether they're forcing patients to undergo what are considered fail first policies or step therapy protocols, or perhaps they are charging higher copays for mental health care compared with medical or surgical care. You know, you don't often hear when somebody has cancer and your doctor says you need chemotherapy, an insurance company saying, well, you know, you can only have that chemotherapy if you try a less aggressive, less intensive, less costly medication first and show that that doesn't work. You know, often the insurance companies will listen to the oncologist or another doctor. But with mental health care, you know, over the course of the past year, we heard stories like this all the time. Someone was in the midst of a mental health crisis who needed intensive treatment, you know, for example, several weeks in an inpatient mental health facility or substance use facility. And this insurer will only improve coverage for lower levels of care first, you know, or some patients having to fail first at lower levels before getting approval for more care. Or as we're seeing with Benji, you know, the insurance company only approving a shorter number of hours than what his medical team believes is appropriate for him. You know, this, if patients undergo this kind of these limitations, you know, it can put them at risk of harm, you know, whether it be overdose or suicide, or, you know, for the case of kids who are seeking developmental therapies, you know, it could potentially put them back as they're trying to develop skills which are really important for their independence and their safety.
We're speaking with Annie Waldman, reporter at ProPublica, covering healthcare. And you can read her piece, United Health is Strategically Limiting Access to Critical Treatment for Kids with Autism, on our website at yourcallradio.org or on the ProPublica website. I'm Ethan Elkind. I'm sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and you're listening to Your Calls Media Roundtable. We also want to hear from you. If you or someone in your family or someone you know is dealing with autism and has a story about how they've been affected by their health insurance company, we would love to hear from you. You could join the conversation by calling us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. So Annie, I know experts have said that there's, due to greater awareness and improved screening, there's been a fourfold increase over the past two decades, from one in 150 to one in 36 in terms of cases of diagnosed childhood autism. So how widespread do you think this challenge is now? And I say challenge, what I really mean is just this practice of a health insurance company like United Health really discriminating against people with these conditions and limiting their access to treatment. I know you profiled Benji extensively, but how widespread do you think this problem is?
That's a great question. So, you know, when we looked at these documents and the internal strategy, what was so interesting was that Optum was focused on the patients who are part of their Medicaid plans. So this, you know, essentially a lot of the Medicaid plans that we have in this country, they are managed by private insurance companies. So even though they're funded by the government, The private insurance companies like United Healthcare manage the benefits and are able to do, you know, reviews on the care to make sure that that care is quote unquote medically necessary. And when they manage Medicaid benefits, states often pay the private insurers a fixed amount of funds per patient, regardless of the frequency or intensity of services used. So when companies spend less than the allotted payment, they're typically allowed to keep some or all of what remains, which federal investigators and experts have acknowledged may be incentivizing insurers to limit care. And so what we have found is that many states are allowing families who have children with substantial needs to enroll their kids in the Medicaid plans, which is why you're seeing a higher increase of need within these Medicaid plans and why United appears to be focusing the strategy on the Medicaid plans. According to our documents, you know, United administers Medicaid plans or benefits in about two dozen states and for more than 6 million people. And this includes about 10,000 children with autism spectrum disorder. And according to the documents, you know, the company knows that this need is only going to increase. So even though we did focus mostly on Benji's story, you know, I do believe that this is something that is impacting families across the country, at least by how it looks like in these internal documents.
And you described how this is a mental health issue with autism, and maybe this kind of strategy that we're seeing from United Health wouldn't come into play with something like cancer, as you described a moment ago. So is this something that we only really should be concerned about in terms of healthcare insurance company practices for mental health conditions? Does this affect more than just autism? Do you think it's more widespread, in other words, than just autism? Or do we also need to worry about it for non-mental health conditions? In other words, how widespread is this approach that the insurance companies are taking to deny access to treatment that they know will make a difference?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's clear from a lot of the public conversation over the past few months that denials are something that are pervasive across our health insurance system, regardless of whether you're talking about mental and behavioral health care or physical and medical kind of surgical health care. That being said, you know, the main difference between mental and behavioral health care and kind of physical conditions is that often with the mental and behavioral conditions, there's not an X-ray that gives an objective diagnosis or, you know, sense of a treatment plan in the same way that there can be for physical conditions. You know, there's not a blood test necessarily that can show the seriousness or, you know, the severity of somebody's condition and therefore, you know, warrant some kind of specific treatment plan. Oftentimes with mental health and behavioral conditions, it requires a very holistic and subjective approach, which can be questioned and interrogated by insurance companies in ways that enable them to use oftentimes standards that they create internally in order to deny or withhold care. And so what we have seen is that, you know, even though these denials are kind of pervasive across the health insurance industry, they oftentimes are much more common with mental health, and they are oftentimes not even appealed because they, you know, people who are going through mental health crisis or behavioral health conditions may not have the bandwidth in order to appeal a case. So, you know, even though these issues are common on both sides, what we are seeing on the mental health side is that there is just a unique complexity. And therefore, that's why legislators in 2008 passed this Mental Health Parity Act in order to require insurance companies to not discriminate against people who are seeking mental health coverage for their conditions.
So it sounds like some federal protections, but I wanted to ask you about the role of the states here. What is the role for the states to exercise some kind of oversight over what companies like United Health are doing and how they're operating? And what kind of relationships just financially are there between a health insurance company like United Health and the state? What kind of, is there public funding involved here and other points of potential leverage that states could have?
That's a great question. And what we're seeing is actually states are oftentimes innovating these protections on the ground before the federal government has been able to. So, you know, states like California, for example, have passed laws in recent years that are trying to put consumer protections in place for people who have health insurance plans in the state. You know, for example, California recently passed a law which is trying to require health insurance companies in the state to follow generally accepted standards of care, which means that insurance companies should not focus on and rely on their own internal standards to adjudicate whether a mental health claim should be approved or denied. They should rely on outside professional standards that are developed by associations and professional committees who are non-biased and not working for the insurance company. So that California has taken that step to put these greater protections in place. But, unfortunately, it only applies to plans that are covered, that are regulated by California state insurance associations or the California state, essentially. You know, most people get their insurance through their employers. And if they do get their insurance through their employers, that insurance is regulated by federal law, not state law. And so you have this patchwork of insurance regulation across the country that really allows insurance companies to kind of have different standards which they are held to. And it really depends on where you live and what kind of insurance you have as to how much protection you have with your insurance plan.
Well, definitely speaks to the need for a federal role to create a more level and fair playing field, it seems to me. I do want to go to the phone lines because we have Carl in Oakland calling in. So, Carl, welcome to your call.
Thank you very much. This process recently happened to my family. I have a 10-year-old son with autism. My question is, what's the role of the actual service provider? In our case, the service provider was saying that we needed to be graduated, that he was actually seeing progress, but at the same time, they felt that he was stagnating. They gave us a conflicting message, and they basically told us that the services were no longer to be rendered. And that was coming from the provider itself, not from our health insurance.
Yeah, Carl, great question. Annie, thoughts about the role of the provider here? So not just the insurance company, but what providers, what culpability they might have or what responsibility they might have to try to ensure the access to treatment.
Yeah, you know, that's a great point. I think that ultimately the service providers, they play a really important role in kind of fighting the insurance companies to get coverage of the care. And so, you know, if providers don't want to go up against insurance companies to get coverage, it can put families in a really difficult and challenging perspective. Earlier this year, you know, my colleagues and I actually did a story called Why I Left the Network, which really details the challenges that mental health and behavioral health providers are facing right now when it comes to insurance companies. They often, you know, will have to provide services for patients, whether it be for children with autism or for patients that they're seeing in psychotherapy up front. And then oftentimes they may have their funding or their payments clawed back later on down the line when the payments are challenged. Or they, you know, have to deal with intensive clinical reviews all the time that they're not paid for. So there's an added pressure on providers when it comes to insurance companies. And that's something that oftentimes patients and their loved ones don't see, that there's this internal struggle that these providers have with insurance companies, and they often don't even want to put it on the patients, which is why they're not even aware of it.
Well, thank you, Carl, for that question. Annie Waldman, reporter at ProPublica, since you profiled Benji so much in your piece, I just wanted to ask, how is Benji and Benji's family and caregivers doing now? What's the follow-up?
Yeah, so they're actually just a few days away from their administrative law review, where they're going to try to overturn the denial that they received from Optum and United Health Group. I am kind of sitting here waiting to hear how it goes. I do hope that they get the justice that they believe that they deserve. You know, when it comes to these stories, you know, the process for getting coverage, particularly when you're faced with a denial, it can take a lot of time. You know, and that's something that a lot of, as you know, Carl was just mentioning, a lot of providers don't have the time and energy to kind of go up against the insurance companies to do this. And without, you know, Benji's clinical team being completely on board as they have been, I think it would be really difficult for his family to kind of pursue coverage of his care as they have been.
And real quick, because we're just about out of time, are there any resources you'd recommend, resources maybe that Benji's family's taking advantage of, or that you'd recommend for listeners in this situation?
Yeah, I just think it's really important to kind of understand the fine details of your individual health plan. You know, really understand what is owed to you, because I think a lot of times people get so overwhelmed with health insurance that they don't want to read the fine print. They don't want to read, you know, what is owed to them and entitled to them in their plan. I think it's really important to kind of prepare yourself and kind of armor yourself with information and have that information. So you go into these conversations ready to kind of, you know, say what you know that you're entitled to.
Yeah. And Annie, just briefly, what are you working on next?
Well, we're still looking at health insurance and we're still looking at mental health care. So I do welcome any tips to us, whether it be from patients, providers, or industry insiders. We're really trying to kind of hear stories from all perspectives as we continue to look at health insurance.
All right. Well, Annie Wallman, reporter at ProPublica, covering healthcare with the piece, United Health is Strategically Limiting Access to Critical Treatment for Kids with Autism. Thank you so much for joining us on Your Call and for covering this really important issue.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's our show. To listen to past shows and sign up for our podcast, you can visit yourcallradio.org. We'll also have a link to that ProPublica piece there, as I mentioned. And you can find us, of course, on iTunes. You can give us a review. If you have any show ideas and feedback, email us at yourcall@kalw.org. Malihe Razazan produced today's show. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and it's Your Call.